Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome you to another special edition of Africa on the Move. That's right, Africa is on the Move. And we will continue our series on Africa Liberation Day 2014 and African Unity. That's our theme. We want to highlight and celebrate and commemorate the institution of Africa Liberation Day 2014, which in essence has been in existence for over 56 years, since 1958, April the 15th, at the first independent conference in Ghana, the Independent Conference of Independent African States. And in 1963, May the 25th, there was the founding of the Organization of African Unity, and they changed it from Africa Freedom Day to African Liberation Day. And we want to continue this historical legacy of uplifting Africa and our pursuit for the total liberation, unification of our people in our home, Africa. And discuss that particular theme with us tonight, we have some very well active participants in this particular field who will be sharing their expertise as we talk about African unity. Right now, what we want to do is we're going to bring on Brother Haki from the African Awareness Association, and we're going to ask Brother Haki to briefly introduce himself to our audience and talk a little bit about his organization. Brother Haki, welcome to Africa on the Move.
Hey, thanks for having me, brother. My name is Haki Kamasi Mushoki, and I've been doing this organizing over 30 years. I'm primarily interested in issues as pertains to social economic justice in terms of the way in which these things are lacking in the African community. So I'd like to see institutions, you know, come about to address a lot of these social issues that impact on our people.
Okay, good. Next we have with us also Brother Singor. He's organizer for the UNIA. He's going to give a brief introduction in terms of who he is and talk to us a little bit about the nature of his work in our community. Welcome, Brother Singor, to Africa on the Move.
Yes. Greetings. This is Brother Singor Jawara Baye. I've been in the movement for over 48 years, active. Actually, I serve currently as the President General, the ninth successor to the Right Excellent Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. I've been active in the UNIAACL, founded by Garvey in 1914, for the last 35 years. I've served in many capacities, but more importantly, I have been a participant with every ALD that has come through Banneker City, Washington, D.C., except for one, and that's only because I was in another country celebrating African Liberation Day. So I'm honored to be with you. I see myself as a revolutionary activist, but serving as the President General of the UNIACL government of the world, I have a tremendous task before me. We'll talk about that later on.
Okay, thank you, my brother. Father and Brother Singor, we have with our sister Isael Dainto. She's a representative of the Haiti Lawyers Network. Sister Isael, can you speak a little bit about who you are and the nature of the work that you've been doing in our communities?
Yes, hi. Esli Dantal. I'm the head of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network. I have been doing Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network for for more than 20 years. And we run the Free Haiti Movement. I write. I'm also a performance poet, so I travel across the whole international, different continents to talk about the colonial narrative on Haiti and to talk about the U.S. occupation of Haiti since 2004. We also run, since the earthquake, a clean water and energy, solar power energy project where we send market women to get educated about operating solar energy panels to provide clean water so that they can be not drink the water that the UN is giving them, which is full of cholera.
All right. Excellent, excellent. And next we have with us Brother Anthony Williams, who is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. Brother Anthony, welcome to Africa on the Move. Can you tell the people a little bit about you and the nature of the work that you and your organization is doing in our community?
Oh, revolutionary greetings, Brother Africa, Brother Haki, and Sister Izili. Thank you for having me on your program today. As you indicated, I'm an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, D.C., which is the inheritor and continuator of the legacy and works of Sashifo Kwame Nkrumah, Ahmed Sekou Touré, and Kwame Touré. The All African People's Revolutionary Party was founded by Kwame Nkrumah in Guinea in 1968. And since 1976, we have been organizing ALD commemorations in the diaspora as well as at home on the continent.
Excellent. We're going to start off tonight with Brother Senghor. And one of the reasons why we're starting off with Brother Senghor, because we think that this institution of that we call African Liberation Day typifies the essence in terms of what his organization has always been about, the UNIA and its history and its development by the creator of Marcus Mosiah Mugabe. Brother Senghor, African Liberation Day is an institution that is a part of the Pan-African movement as well as the social movement. But more importantly, we want to talk about Pan-Africanism, the importance of Pan-Africanism, based upon when Garvey conceived of building UNIA, he conceived the possibility and the realization of Africa for African people at home and abroad, and to be a strong down Africa. Can you talk to our people just a little bit about the historical development of this concept of Pan-Africanism and how that thing will work once it comes to fruition?
Absolutely, my brother. First of all, let me say hello to my brother Anthony and all the others on the line. It's always a pleasure to be amongst Africans who are raising their consciousness to move forward to liberate us all over the world, but Africa as our homeland. Of course, I'm not going to go all into the history because we are celebrating the 100th centennial of the founding of the UNIA, July the 20th, 1914 in Jamaica. Of course, it has progressed. We have gone through all kinds of struggles and trials and tribulations maintaining ourselves as a government because the fact that maintains itself, even though we are a movement, we have a lot of entities that we have collaborated with over many, 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 many years. The first African Independence Day was established in 1920 on August the 31st. We've always seen the African Liberation Movement started in 1958, progressed in 1963, as a continuation of some of the manifestation of Pan-Africanism, of Africans coming together. Now, one of the most important things with our centennial and the UNIACL in the 21st century is we're working to collaborate and work with all revolutionaries despite the minor differences that we have. We know we as Africans have far more in common, and it is critical for us to organize around our commonalities and to go up against the system of white supremacy and, in fact, our own apathy amongst African people all over the world. Of course, we know the apathy comes from engineering of taking our people out of knowing their true history, heritage, and culture. So the UNIACL today is continuing the works of our ancestors who founded the UNIA and collaborating with all progressive forces, regardless of whether or not they consider themselves an institution, organization, or a movement. What we mean by that is, even in Africa today, neocolonialism is still very much alive, and many of our people on the continent are suffering. That suffering takes place all over the world. My sister who spoke about Haiti, it is critical that we recognize the struggles that our Haiti went through in terms of going up against the system of white supremacy very long time ago. But it's important for us to recognize that we have to build, as we tear down the systems of oppression, we have to build strategical methods to reach the critical mass in the areas of food, clothing, and shelter. So today, the UNIACL is working not only to collaborate with folks on the continent, all over the world, in fact. We're rebuilding the UNIA. We're building around solar energy, around sustainable development, and we're organizing to follow the works, words, and deeds of many of our ancestors like George Washington Carver, Henry Sylvester Williams, Anna Julia Cooper, and it's so many. I could go on and on and on. But the fact of the matter is we see ourselves as the ancestral energy today in us as being responsible of attacking all of those, whether or not they are directors, you know, workers with the system of white supremacy as Europeans, or whether or not they're Africans who have been hoodwinked to not know themselves and come up against the progressive forces that are striving to raise up and go against all of the various both white and black governments all over the world who continue to oppress our people and consequently continue to take resources from the continent and kill our people. So in closing, let me just say the UNIACL today in the centennial will be in Harlem, New York. A lot of the programs that we're involved with, a lot of the institutions, the movements that we've aligned ourselves with are many. They will be joining us in Harlem. But all over the world, we're calling on all Africans because the UNIA was not established for those of us who pay our dues and keep the upkeep of the government. It was actually established for all Africans. So whether or not it be the AAPRPCG or whether or not it be the Republic of New Africa, the National Black United Front, the Nation of Islam, or et cetera, we call all Africans back to the oneness that is required because what we really are lacking is power. And to go up against the system of oppression, if you don't have power, you will be crushed. And it is critical for us in the 21st century to reach young people and let young people know the revolution continues. So many of us are dying today because we don't know who we are or our great legacy.
Okay, well, thank you, brother. With that transition, we'd like to go to our brother, Anthony Williams, organizer for the AAPRPGC, as we continue to talk about this historical legacy of the building of Pan-Africanism and the struggle for trying to unite our people. Brother Anthony, your party has been very significant in terms of the last 20 to 30 years of playing a significant role of bringing Africans together all around the world from different countries to organize together as one entity. What is the present condition of the African people from your perspective as it relates to the realities in terms of what's going on day around the world? How do you view the present realities of the African people? And what are some of the fundamental issues that your organization views as the most critical issues that we must look at right now in terms of prioritization? How do you prioritize this particular struggle from a Pan-African perspective?
I would say today, that our biggest problem is our lack of organization, which implies unity, but that's only one aspect of it. And the number one barrier facing our people presently is imperialism and all of its manifestations. And the dominant form in which Africans have to contend with imperialism today is neocolonialism, which is a system in which the oppression of Africans is continued under a minority of people that look like us. They do not represent the majority, but they have the support of the various imperialist forces in terms of dominating the various institutions in our communities, such as religious, media, educational, athletics, entertainment, et cetera. And so right now, and that's the reason for our theme, smash the neocolonialist intelligentsia, the true face of the counter-revolution, because we feel that today that is the dominant manifestation of imperialism, which is continuing to oppress Africans and people around the world. Also, we feel that the number one problem today is our lack of organization. And we must get better organized than we have been because, a disorganized people cannot go up against effectively an organized enemy. And that is the biggest impediment we see today. And that's why our program is to build a mass independent Pan-African political party, the AAPRPGC.
And we understand that African Liberation Day will be taking place this weekend. Can you just talk a little bit about when, where, and again, what's the theme?
Certainly. We'll be commemorating African Liberation Day this year in Washington, D.C., at the Festival Center located at 1640 Columbia Road, Washington, D.C., Northwest, Northwest Washington, D.C. And for more information, you can visit our website, www.a-aprp-gc.org, or you can contact us at 202-719-0529. Also, our theme this year is Smash the Neocolonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. And we have invited various political organizations that are also struggling against imperialism, and they'll be providing some background on their developments, as well as a detailed analysis of how the neocolonialist intelligentsia, contributes to our oppression.
Excellent. We'll make our next transition to Brother Haki of the African Women's Association. Brother Haki, how you doing again? And can you speak to this issue of the necessity around this question of having a clear understanding of who you are, the identity question? And we ask that because we know the African Women's Association, one of the goals of that organization is to try to make Africans realize no matter where they are Africans. And you want to build a bridge to unite us with each other. So as you travel around, based upon your traveling, just speak about a little bit of the importance of why it's important for us to internalize and understand that we are Africans. Because right now, there seemed to be a movement of we begin to go backwards. So can you give our people just a perspective on this crucial aspect of the necessity to understand who we are as people, that we are African people, period.
But one of the things is that it's clear in terms of identifying Africa, then we understand a common struggle, a common problem. And that's very key. You know, as I walk around this country, one of the things I find horrifying is the fact that so many of the youth identify, with being American. And the thing that bothers me in particular with that is that when you see yourself American, then you have to internalize certain kind of values. Values like individualism, values like selfishness, values like greed. All tend to make for a very chaotic, destructive kind of person, and I'm very concerned about that. Not to mention that it leaves a person ill-equipped to actually deal with the conditions that we're inflicted with. So by us internalizing these U.S. values, then what happens is that whatever the government does, we see it as justified. So we legitimize all kind of insanity under the guise of being American. So we look at unemployment, and we look at people don't have affordable housing. We look at the poor educational system. We look at all these things, and as opposed to anger and affronting people, our people tend to accept under the guise that we have to be a good American. I have to accept it. And I'm also concerned that once you internalize this whole notion in terms of individualism, and that you see yourself at the center of the universe, then I'm afraid that in terms of your analysis, there's a real temptation that you may believe that based upon your circumstances relative to others, that in fact others' problems are a result of their own doing. And so we still understand systemic nature in terms of the how the system negatively impacts on the lives of African people. Now, when we talk about impact on the lives of African people, now we're not just talking about Africans in America. Now, we talk about Africans throughout the diaspora. And so when you look at the conditions in terms of the level of oppression, and you look at socioeconomic indicators, wealth. When you look at education levels, when you look at incarceration rates, they negatively impact on African people, and there's no question about that. And the question for our people is what we're going to do about that. But before we can even address that question, what are we going to do about it, the question is, you know, do I understand fundamentally, you know, that this is a problem that's unique to African people? And so one of the things I try to get young people to understand is that whenever you talk about, you know, why it's important to be Africa, when they raise this nefarious notion in terms of being American, what I say to them is that you're in a situation in this country now where the economy is actually deteriorating. You've got huge disparity between those who have and those who don't have. You've got 1% of the population controlled over 90% of the wealth. Now, clearly, in the mindset of capitalists, then that means that if you don't have wealth or access to wealth, then your life is expendable. I mean, your whole existence on this planet is superfluous. So what does that mean to you as an African? So at some point, you have to raise the question, you know, do I want to be American, or do I want to be a human being? Do I want to be the best human being I can be? And so that is a quintessential question in terms of our youth and getting them to understand, but institutions, we need institutions to sort of reinforce those values, those ideas in terms of who they are and forming their allegiance in terms of struggle as it relates to the freeing up of our people, you know, throughout the world. So it's very important, very, very important that our kids understand that all our people understand we're African. I think Peter Tosh said it best when he said, as long as you're a black man, you're an African.
All right. And we go to our sister Izili from representing the Haitian community. You know, when we often think about Haiti, when we think about the West presentation of Haiti, it's totally different when you go and really do your own research. And what we would like to do tonight for this particular audience is to ask our sister to give us a clear perspective of the role and the contributions and the struggles of the Haitian people. What are the positive things that our people can take from their struggle? And at the same time, why Haiti has been very important to the struggle of Africans in the West and throughout the world. Sister, can you give us a some kind of historical background in the history and the struggles of the Haitian people? Who are the real Haitian people?
I say honor and respect to all your panelists and to the audience that is listening. Haiti is the first place in the Western Hemisphere where Africans were brought in slave in chains, that after 300 years in combat beat the French, the Spanish, the English, and U.S. mercenaries and U.S. Embargo to become Haiti, the land where the amalgamated Africans became one, so that though we were from West Africa all the way down going to Angola and the Congo, Benin, and so forth, we became one family, so that you don't see Haitians saying, I am, of a particular different culture. We are all Haitian. That means, I think, is revolutionary and critical for our times today. Today, Haiti is under occupation again after 200 years of neocolonialism. So I think we are pretty much experts at what neocolonialism is. So we did not have direct enslavement after 1804. After 1804, Haiti took its independence in combat. But the Europeans could not, and white supremacy would not, and still does not, allow for black independence. So in various forms, it keeps reinventing itself, reinventing its domination, even when it has to take a different gender and put it on that same label of the old boys network, or a different race like Obama and put it on the same old white supremacist system. So we are in that space now where the white supremacy has used all that has been gained in progressive movements and turned it on its head, and makes it a reinvention of the same old feudal landlord sort of serfdom that they are used to in Europe with their kings and queens and have just rearranged it. But the masses in the world are pretty much providing resources and livelihoods for a tiny, tiny global elite, mostly white, and their collaborators. What I think is critical for those listening to me to understand is this. The Pentagon and these folks, they have think tanks and they have money and they're not in crisis. Our communities are constantly in crisis, constantly in poverty, constantly trying to pay the monies to the grid so that they can have an overhead of a house, electricity, car, and other things. So much so that I think that it's difficult for folks to provide leadership. And those who started out very well with regards to providing leadership normally get bought out. So I want to bring to your audience some semblance of leadership, because that's what we try to do. That's the reason I founded the Haitian Lawyers Leadership 20 years ago, but I have spent my entire life as a Haitian, and that just means that from the womb to the tomb, our lives is about struggle. And historically, this is how that's represented. So after 300 years of enslavement, from 1503, when the first boatloads of Africans were brought in, to 1804, so 300 years of free labor, 300 years of being breaded like, you know, animals and considered livestock without a soul, not a human being. The Africans in Haiti finally, now, of course, you know that we are always fighting. Today, even though the right-wing white supremacist has co-opted most of all of the gains of our civil rights folks, most of the gains that folks have worked so hard in, and the intelligentsia is so absolutely useless all across the diaspora in Haiti and in America. There is always brothers and sisters who don't fight, who live and die with that path. I like to think that the Haitian Lawyers Leadership represents those folks, those who live and die fighting that path. We have a motto that we follow at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership and that we teach. We don't do the traditional old white man ideologies, whether it's Marxism, any of their religion. It just doesn't resonate with me, and so, frankly, that's not what I teach. This is what I teach. I teach that at Bois Caïman, at the gathering that began the Haitian Revolution, the Bois Caïman call is what we stand on today, and we think that if Africans took that call global, we would get our freedom fairly quickly. And that was said in the King Kongo language by Bookman, who was a Jamaican who had gone into, you know, a guy from the territory that's called Jamaica. So the Haitian Revolution, to be clear, was done by many Africans all over the Caribbean, people who had been fighting since they found chains on their feet and so forth. And that call, as I always say, it's A.A. Mombamba Kanga Mondele Kanga Bafioti Kanga Njoki Kanga Yo. And it means kill the black collaborators, kill the colonists, kill the all of their evil forces. Others translate that to mean stop them, stop the black collaborators, stop the colonists, stop their evil forces. That is our call. We don't try to sugarcoat it. This is what has to be done. This is what was done for the only country that in the world history that cuts its chains from its enslavers, the tyrants, and the despots. And so that's what we teach at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership. We say wherever you stand, whatever you can do, you must denounce the black collaborators. You must denounce the colonists, the imperialists, in whatever form they take, Right now, they're taking the form of civil society, so they're hidden amongst us. You must be clear as to what the goal is. And the third part of that, which is stop the Nojoki, which means they're evil forces, back in 1791, that meant the various institutions that were used to maintain and extend and promote white supremacy. And those institutions are still the same things, basically, that they were back in 1791. Our ancestors understood them to be their religion that makes them God, and therefore you're very, very hesitant with killing God. Their religion, their educational system that's very deceptive, that keeps many of us in not seeing what's going on around us for many, many, many years. That's what we stand for at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership. And we are in a dire, dire situation in Haiti, because in Haiti, contrary to other places on the planet, there is some semblance of solidarity with others in the world. Right now, I can tell you literally all of the nations are in Haiti. And it's very metaphorically, it's sort of, Haiti represents what the black African liberation, where our status is today. So if you look at Haiti, you will understand where our status is today. And I say that because there are some lights, as we were saying yesterday, Brother Mugabe over there in Zimbabwe fighting so hard is, in my opinion, the only light in the African continent at the moment. Laurent Gbagbo, you know, was just taken down, and nobody really said anything with regards to those who we readily know as the leaders. And I speak only of the ones that are put out there by the white supremacist folks, you know, whether Congressional Black Caucus or all of those guys and women. So you had Muammar Gaddafi taken down. I want to note, in terms of the Boko Haram, that these Al-Qaeda resurgence in Africa, divide and conquer, that's their blueprint. So the United States and NATO helped to allow a lot of the terrorism that's happening right now, because they used Al-Qaeda mercenaries to take down Muammar Gaddafi over there in Libya, and these are the same people that are reported to have been arming folks like the Boko Haram and the other terrorists over in the Northwest Africa up there. But so what I think, I mean, specifically with regards to Haiti, you know that 200 years after our independence, the imperialists came back for the first time in 200 years in 2004. You have a situation where on our bicentennial, now a white man is very, very, he's not someone who forgets when he's been beaten. And so this is the price that Haiti has been paying. And so they came back, particularly France, puts its boots in Haiti for the first time in 200 years as soldiers in 2004 when they took out democratically elected President Aristide. Folks must understand geographically Haiti stands between Cuba and Venezuela, Cuba to the west and Venezuela down by the south. Both of those folks, both of those countries have oil. Both of those countries have rejected U.S. hegemony. And so, you know, Haiti was the weak link. The United States is losing its grip, even though it is the biggest superpower in the world. It's losing its grip, actually, with capitalism coming to its sort of logical end. It has to figure out a way to reinvent itself. And so as it loses, one of the places that it can reaffirm itself is in this defenseless country called Haiti. Without a European mother or fatherland, we stand alone, because as you all know, CARICOM is made up of, you know, countries, all island countries, who have fatherlands that are in Europe. And so Haiti is the one that stands there alone with no solidarity, with no big dog World War II vetoing power country that would say to the U.S., back the hell off. Now, there was a point in time back in 91 when they did the first coup d'etat when China hadn't reached, you know, the amount of power it needed to, so it certainly, you know, helped us in vetoing the U.S. occupation of Haiti. But today, China and the United States have reached some sort of, although they're competitive, as we can see with regards to the Sudan, they can rape women with the Mujahideen over there. They try to get rid of all the black out of the Sudan, even though Sudan means black. And the United States, you know, will pull back and allow that to happen because China gets 60% or 80%, whatever it is, 60 to 70% of its oil from the Sudan. And so the process is kill as many of the black woman's child as possible, provide as many ethnic or and they define what ethnic is, provide all of the various divisions as possible. And as you know, men, strong men in Africa, is their whatever you call that, their pattern. And so in Haiti we have that, you know, the pattern of Mobutu Duvalier. And I lived through it in my as a young attorney. I represented President Aristide in 91 to 96, excuse me, until 95 actually. He went back to Haiti in 94. And in that time, I watched the United States come out of the sort of 80s military way of outwardly taking over a country because it had, you know, that rubric of communism, stopping the evil of communism. Well, it didn't have that anymore, and so it turned itself into bringing democracy. And so created all of these civil society organizations that had one constituent that did not represent the masses and funded them through something called the charitable industrial complex, otherwise known as the NGOs. And these are the tools of empire that they used, including the fact that the media was bought off to create a whole different narrative than what the reality of the universe is. So they have what we call those evil forces, which is like the media, the schooling, those civil society forces, and those are the things that we try to expose at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership. We try to expose the colonial narrative on Haiti. You will find my work on the Esli Dumpal blog. We have 6 or 7 different blogs. I've been out here for decades. So we have an archive of work. We know, I know, that I probably my lifetime will go by without folks ever discovering the Esli Dumpal Network. But that is what, you know, our fathers stood for, is that we work from one generation to the other, from the womb to the tomb, and the idea is liberty or death. We will not accept this occupation. Haiti was occupied before for 19 years, and without any other help, we did get rid of that occupation, and that's the reason I exist, is because, you know, the Haitians did get rid of that occupation. So our story is not told. What you see, what they tell you about Haiti is mostly half-truth. Let me get some specific with regards to so we know what the call is of the Free Haiti movement and the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, and it's, you know, stop the black collaborators, stop the imperialists, and stop their evil forces, and explain what some of those evil forces are in terms of education, the civil society, and their NGOs, and so forth, and how that works in Haiti, how that works if you can, their pattern is the same, how it works in Ukraine right now, how it worked in Libya. Their military is part of their evil forces. And so what we do is provide inspiration by telling the story of the Haitian Revolution, the pattern that was used in order for our people to win, and by giving really specifics as to what's going on right now. Right now, for instance, the United States, once it took out President Aristide, who I was the legal advisor to, once he took out President Aristide, then they brought in their non-governmental NGOs. It's been said that Haiti is the republic of NGOs. There are more NGOs in Haiti than anywhere else in the world at the moment. Some of them have been going out because, you know, what they do is they collect money, not just on the exploitation of the, and what I'm saying for Haiti is a microcosm of everywhere else in the world, including the United States. They exploit the natural resources of Haiti clandestinely because they have to keep saying that we are poor in order to keep out adventurers and provide, just, you know, take the money for those that know. So Haiti, for those who don't know, have more oil, according to Haitian geologists, than Venezuela. And Venezuela has the most oil reserves in the Western Hemisphere. Geologists say that the oil in Haiti is the head of the oil of that's in Venezuela. Haiti has gold. You know, obviously, you know, Christopher Columbus and all those rapists and pedophiles had, you know, taken out a lot of Haiti's gold. But we are a country of many, many mountains. And because we are one of the oldest landmass, other than Cuba, we are the oldest landmass in the Americas. Volcanic eruption with lots and lots of amazing and strategic minerals that the United States uses. And so that one of the reasons you see all of this climate change, that have crisis after crisis in Haiti, is because they're digging up the mountains and taking out the various minerals that are there. They have admitted that Haiti has $20 billion in gold. They're getting ready to change the Haitian Constitution again under this occupation, as Roosevelt did under the first occupation, to provide for open-pit mining. And now this is in addition to the fact that they brought us cholera with the Nepalese colonial soldiers that they have in Haiti, a cholera which since October 2010 has killed 10,000 Haitians, has infected 850,000 Haitians. And that's why at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, we found we had to bring that project of solar energy, clean power, and self-reliance to the Haitian women so that they could have ways of keeping themselves from dying. So from one generation to the other, we try to survive the barbarity of these tyrants. Even though my project, Zili Dlo, is very, very small, we have I went to Minister Farrakhan in 2000, and I can't remember, but it was right after the earthquake, 2010, basically trying to figure one person who might have resources and access to help us when the earthquake happened. You know, obviously we said, because we had been dealing with these NGOs and these fake benevolence of the civil society folks, that we knew they would not let the people die. So 320,000 Haitians died in 53 seconds. A lot of people talk about fracking, and it's the way it destroys the provides earthquake. Well, in Haiti, you know, we have two fault lines, one in the north and one in the south. In the south, right there, for those who know the geography, you could see the Gulf of Port-au-Prince. In those waters is where most of our oil is, and around the coastal areas. So they were basically doing all sorts of exploitation. Now, those who don't know, after they took out President Aristide in 2004, the U.S. built the fourth largest embassy of the United States in Tiny, supposedly have no resources and no strategic interest for the United States. They built the fourth largest U.S. embassy in Haiti. And that process is also part of the process of digging down into Haiti, because they have tunnels that they've built from below their compounds, going out to the sea and going up to the north where the other resources are, so that you really, right now, they hide what they're doing in Haiti, just like, you know, they've hidden a lot of their drone fly, whatever you call them, the various airports. They have these clandestine airports where they fly their drones and so forth. Well, they have a lot of those things in Haiti too. So we are dealing with a different sort of colonialism. It's a hidden colonialism. It's not a direct colonialism like you had in Africa or like you had in Haiti before our independence. This colonialism is hidden by false benevolence, because it's humanitarian imperialism, like they're going to come in to save you from something. I mean, this is how they use it. They're going to bring you back democracy, like Clinton came in to bring us democracy from 1994 when they brought back President Aristide. But what that was about was re-imaging the Duvalieris. So right now, the Duvalieris, who are the black collaborators to empire, all they're about, all these Negroes are about is, and this is could be said for all the feudal lords for empire, you know, they may have started out, as I said, as people who want to change, but there's a saying that, you know, the black intelligentsia doesn't really want change. They just want a position of power within the system of white supremacy, like Obama and like our various other so-called leaders. So in Haiti, at the Haitian Boys Leadership, we try to keep, you know, do our part, little parts, with regards to providing clean water and solar power energy. I can tell you that the Clinton Foundation has worked very, very hard to destroy that project, because the more they keep us dependent, the more they, you know, they assure their future with regards to, you know, using Haitian bodies for more money. For example, instead of providing clean water and cleaning the water that they have destroyed, Clinton and Global Initiative is giving vaccines to the people, short-term vaccines that requires short-term. So that means that you take it, and then in 2 years later, you got to take it again. Now, if they have to do that ad nauseum for 50 years or however, because when you have an endemic like that, in Nepal, they've had that stuff for 50 years, and it just doesn't go away. You see how much money they can project they're going to be making off of our sickness and death. You must understand also that Obama basically gave the Hillary and Billy Haiti as sort of like the consolation prize, so you can keep him out of his hair with regards to, you know, his political power in the United States. And so they made, as head of the Reconstruction Committee for Haiti, they collected Mr. Bill Clinton at the UN with his wife as State Department head. They presided over the reconstruction of Haiti, which really means bringing back all the Duvaliers who are now in power. Matéli, Lau, and Lamotte are U.S. interest black folks. So $9 billion they collected, leaving little footprint in Haiti, and still they're trying to destroy our project in Haiti, the Clinton Global Initiative. We had gone to a country we thought that wasn't in the Western Hemisphere, at least wasn't in Haiti, and badly. So we went to India, and I made a negotiated deal with them. Well, you know, these guys have much more power, and so they're trying to destroy that deal. It's a very difficult fight. We continue to fight it. We fight it pretty much alone, though. We don't know where the black folks are. You know, they're using the gladiators of the various NFL and Hollywood celebrities and so forth. All of these are colonial celebrityism. They're clueless about what they're sitting there raising their money for and where it's going, except that that money goes to the NGOs, who always have a religious agenda that tries to destroy African indigenous culture. It's Vodun for us. I'm a Vodouist. Esli Dantal is the name of the irreducible essence of the black woman that mounted the priestess at Wakayima. Basically, that essence is what we represent. We try to lift up Haitian culture because we know that if Haitian culture is destroyed totally, if tourism, which is another way of bringing brothels and making black women prostitutes like they do in the Dominican Republic, which, sex trafficking is like the fourth in the world. This is what they're trying to do with Haiti. They are running Matéli and La Marche, who are the government in Haiti that were put into Haiti at the time that it's called the shock doctrine, where crisis is so bad for you that you don't have time or energy or even the breath to fight the next stage. So once everything fell down in Haiti with regards to the earthquake, the UN had been in Haiti for practically 10 years before, basically raping Haitian children, little girls, and you can find all that information on our website. We have been exposing it with impunity, total impunity. If you go to the Haitian hospitals, this is what they do. This is what they call genocide, using rape as genocide as they did in Darfur. They bring the UN soldiers from all these countries. They have disrespect for Haitian women. So you have little children who they give them food for sex. And so you have Haiti is probably the last place where you have this line of Africans who pretty much was left alone. And so there's not this miscegenation going on. But they understand that the more they bring folks to confuse you and disconnect you from your revolutionary path, then so right now we have all of these Pakistanian Haitians, we have whatever. There's all of the nations are in Haiti right now because it's a cushy job. It gives the UN almost $1 billion a year. The United States is the great biggest funder. And we have even Nigerians there, and we tell the Nigerians to go back to Africa and save those girls. Haiti doesn't need you here. But what's even worse is that the countries in the Western Hemisphere who call themselves anti-imperialists, like Bolivia, are sitting in Haiti right now, and Venezuela, who's supposed to be another revolutionary, just gave $27 million to the Bafiotis, to the Black Collaborators, to the Matéli government. And the Matéli government, I'll give you one specific thing that if anybody is listening that we need help on. Matéli government has decreed that all of Haiti's offshore islands are going to be used for foreigners as tourist havens. And there is a place right above Venezuela called Île Avache. It is an island there that back in the day, whatever his name is, Lincoln had sent African American free blacks there to try to get them out of the United States when they were trying to do that. So the legacy of Haiti being a space of asylum for black folks who had no other place to go, well, that space right now, they have about 15 to 20,000 Haitians living on that island. There are fishermen, they are craftsmen, they are farmers. The Matéli government is trying to push them off that island so he can bring in Dominican-type tourism and use those coastal lands for these northerners and make us props in our land the way, in the rest of the 14 other Caribbean nations are props. So the fact that CARICOM, OAS, the UN, the African Union, and countries like Venezuela and Cuba are not at all denouncing the U.S. occupation under Haiti is very disappointing. And so we stand at the Free Haiti Movement and we say, down with the U.S. occupation, down with privatization of Haiti assets for foreign global elites, which is what they're doing, and the land grab. And they have carted into prison, for instance, the community leader. His name is Jean Lamy Martinez. You can find this information at esleydantal.com. And we're trying to get Jean Lamy Martinez to be freed so that he can come back to his community and continue to agitate and say, we have lived on this land. We have paid over and over again for this land. And now this collaborator is declaring this land is no longer our land, and taking it away from us. And that's basically what's going on in Haiti at the moment and what we represent at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership.
Okay, Mr. Sus, we thank you. We're going to make a transition to my brother, Brother Senghor. I know he's only has a few minutes, but we would like to at least get him to say a couple of final words to our audience as relates to the necessity of supporting this whole concept of African Liberation Day and our people dealing with it. Brother Senghor, can you say a few final words?
First, I want to thank my sister for that information, and I want to thank all the listeners and say that it is critical, not only based on what she shared, but what all of us are about, to collaborate and come more one together to address the issues with solutions. So because I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to give you a series of websites, and I encourage each one of you all, particularly my sister and everybody else on the call and all the listeners, to check these websites out, and let's connect. Let's connect and let's do this work that we got to do. Visit www.uniacl.org. Also www.unia-centennial.org. And also, this is very important in terms of global connections, www.cbpm stands for Collective Black People's Movement. We've been collecting data for over 15 years of what our people are doing all over the world. That is the cbpm.org site. And then also www.unia-ublackcrossnurses.com. And also, to get in contact with me directly, email me at Senghor, that's S-E-N-G-H-O-R-B, at hotmail.com. And for the last 10 years, we've had our own international radio network. That is www.harambeeradio.com. We have over 40 programmers that we broadcast all over the world. We have many programs on Haiti, et cetera. And last but certainly not least, to reach our youth, the UNIA sponsors another radio network where children as well as adults teach African-centered education every Saturday. That's www.blacklearningchannel.com. I could give you a tremendous amount of other websites, but one of the most important things I want to leave all of you with in terms of liberation, collaboration, and upliftment in the 21st century to address the problems that we are confronted with and to come up with concrete solutions are to collaborate. This is a centennial year. We've been around for 100 years. We have ambassadors like Ambassador Anoko Rashidi, Ambassador Tony Bowder, Ambassador Haru Forai Atta. I could go on with ambassadors all over. Brother Haru has traveled to Haiti and done a lot of different collaborative things, but it is critical that we all come together and know each other, because we are faced with a tremendous amount of problems where our children are being killed all over the world, even in the United States, in Chicago, and different cities. Because we don't know who we are, because we have not addressed coming up with solutions to build forward. As I said, I apologize to you all, but I must leave the call because I'm going back to work to two conference calls tonight. Our centennial celebration is not for Marcus Garvey. It is for the UNIA ACL, created 100-some-odd years ago. It'll be in Harlem, New York, from August the 14th to August the 17th. Our 57th International Convention will follow that in Queens, New York. But Africans everywhere are called to commemorate not only the works of the UNIA, not only the works of all of these fabulous revolutionaries that are on the call, but any progressive groups anywhere in the world must begin to know each other, come together, create our own means of communication, our own means of sustainable development, building through addressing the issue of nature culture. And what we mean by nature culture is knowing our culture and addressing the issues of the land in Africa and wherever we may be. It is absolutely critical that if we don't, those of us that consider ourselves conscious Africans, unite despite our minor differences, with unity without uniformity, but unity certainly around all the issues that we come together around and on. So in closing, let me say to you, Brother Lee, thank you so much. I really appreciate all of what my sister shared. I encourage all listeners to listen to her very carefully, because it is critical that if we cannot address the issues of Haiti, we will not be able to address the issues of Africa. We will not be able to address the issues of north, south, and east of the whole planet. The whole earth is under attack. All of its people on the earth are under attack. And neocolonialism is one tool being utilized for the destruction of the future of the whole human race. But we are race first, and as Marcus Garvey said, up you mighty race, we can accomplish what you will. Dr. Tony Browder is in Kemet, resurrecting Karakamun's tomb. It is critical for us to work and to do the work, and much blood has been shed, much more is going to be shed, but we will win. I say, on with the revolution. African Liberation Day is a critical component of bringing us together, but let's don't be content with the food of chickens. Too many of our children are crying and dying, and the fact that maintains itself, our own apathy must change, and we must rise up and, yes, be organized, 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 as my good brother Kwame Ture, who's a gigantic ancestor in the world, went with Marcus Garvey, clearly said to us, if we don't get organized, we shall perish.
All right, my brother, we thank you. Continue to struggle. As
you hear,
brothers. That was Brother Senghor Bey with the UNIA, giving his perspective on what we must do. And in terms of what we must do, we must continue down this road for liberation. Right now, I would like to bring in my brother Haki. And let's, Haki, Brother Anthony, and Sister Ezilla, start with Brother Haki. Let's just have a dialogue with the community in terms of having a critical discussion on this issue of the role of leadership, the role of the African leadership, past, present, and the future. When we talk about leadership, Brother Haki, from a historical reference, how we end up in the condition that we end up today? What is just your general take, if you had to write the history of the leadership, the historical leadership of African people, particularly when we look at this question of Africans who have been taken away from Africa and brought to the West, start from the West and then we can go back home. What would just be your general story when you write the history of the role of African leadership? What would you say about some of the issues that has occurred within diverse leadership among the African community in the West and then go back to Africa? Just give me a general synopsis of it, because there seemed to be a large disconnect and failure for African people being in such a dire strait, particularly just listen to the recent history of some of the things that is going on in Haiti that my sister just elaborated on. And many of us are aware of it. Most of us are not. But even if we are not, we must ask the reason why we are not aware of it. Who keeping this information from us? But Brother Haki, just give me a general scenario or discuss a little bit of this question of the role of leadership among our people and the contradictions and the things we need to deal with to bring about the kind of leadership that we need.
Well, I think historically, I think when you when our ancestors first came over here to this country, one of the things that we were abundantly clear in terms of our humanity, and as such, we were able to formulate, you know, secretly clandestine meetings in which we raised up, you know, our humanity. For instance, historically, there were such things as hush harbors, in which you know the so-called slaves or our ancestors would sneak away in the caverns and various surreptitious places, and they would actually talk about the role of spirituality, and more importantly, they used to talk about in terms of organization, in terms of freeing themselves from bondage. So even at that point, you had a situation where in the big house you had individuals who sided with the master. As Malcolm X used to say, you know, whenever they sneezed, these Negroes would say, "What's wrong, boss? We sick?" So you had this element that exists. So you had this division of African community. And so the leadership that exists I mean, was prominent. Even though it was underground, it was very, very prominent in terms of influence on African people at that time. Now, if we fast forward in terms of, you know, our progression in the society, one of the things that I think is very, very problematic is that once, you know, we've been socialized into believing this notion that, in fact, that this, in fact, is the greatest country in the world, and, in fact, that we're lucky to even be here. And this whole notion that, in fact, that our people were in Africa were somehow savages swinging from trees, took a lot of minds of African people had some legitimacy. And so, therefore, in their minds, they're very happy to be here. And so, therefore, they internalize all of these very destructive values under the guise of being an American. And, of course, out of that confusion comes your leadership. Now, keep in mind, a lot of the leadership that currently exists is very clear in terms of the contradictions that exist that negatively impact on our people. But they also understand that for them, two things are important, power and status. And so, therefore, they're not willing to struggle on behalf of the masses of our people because for them, power and status defines who they are. Now, any human being who defines himself based upon, you know, those esoteric standards in terms of who are the human being has some serious questions in my mind. By virtue of your humanity, by virtue of being who you are, makes you important. Irrespective of status or wealth or power, it doesn't matter. But when you internalize such ideas, then it's very, very clear that you can never be useful in terms of the masses of people's struggle. In fact, you become an adversary to your own people. And that's precisely what happened. As much as I like to believe, you know, Jesse Jackson has the best interest of our people, when I look at the history of Jesse Jackson, even during the Daily Machine back in Chicago, and I look at the level of opportunism and what he was willing to do in terms of selling his people out for power, then when I see him today, then I recognize that this brother is truly, in a stricter sense of the word, a poverty pimp. So, you know, so this is the kind of problem we have in terms of leadership. The same can be said with respect to Africa in terms of, you know, the leadership. Now, a lot of these brothers and sisters, unfortunately, a lot of them are Western educated, and they, too, have internalized these values. And traveling through Africa and seeing that class division, that class divide in Africa, let me tell you, is very, very real. Now, superimposed upon the tribal situation in Africa, which, fortunately, a lot of the young people are doing a better job at dealing with tribalism, but it still exists. But this notion in terms of internalizing this notion that somehow the superiority to white the superiority to black people, that whites are somehow superior to black folks, is something that proliferates on the continent. And I've been to a lot of countries on the continent, and I've been running into that phenomenon a lot. There was one situation in Kenya in which the guy stood up and said, and he made a speech, and he was talking about the fact that if Africa had the white people back in control, then everything would be okay. The problem is that you got black people who are incapable of leadership. And he actually believes this. And so this epitomizes this kind of mindset in terms of, you know, where they're at in terms of, you know, the ability, you know, to achieve a struggle for self-determination. How you doing? And the leadership in Africa is no different. I got a single suspicion that, you know, as economic society, that this level of self-hatred, you know, self-loathing is pertinent to a lot of African leaders, and so which makes them ill-equipped to actually empower their people or their countries. So, you know, the thing that's particularly difficult to accept is that when you look at the level of devastation and level of hurt in Africa, for all the world to see, when you look at that level of devastation, clearly African leadership understands quite well what is going on. In fact, whenever dollars are provided to Africa under the guise of help, those dollars often find themselves in the coffer of these political leaders. And so, therefore, clearly they understand that without money, there can be no development. But they persist to take the money anyway and live lavish lifestyles. So I think to a large extent they have internalized this Western idea in terms of, you know, that things define who you are. And so, therefore, the more money they have, the more somebody you are because you have more things. Now, and then it does get complicated because you do have, on the other hand, you do have African saints, for instance, In Ghana, there's a proverb which says, if you have a choice between your mother or power, which do you choose? Well, the answer is power. Oh, for me, that's problematic. You know, But it speaks to maybe a mindset that predated colonialism in terms of, you know, people's way of seeing the world and people's aspirations or desire to achieve power. So, and if that's the situation, then, then participating with your oppressor, it's just a natural kind of occurrence. Because if you all about the money, the bling bling, then by participating with these people, you get that. Then in your mind, then you're complete as a human being. So historically, this is a problem in terms. This is a problem impact on our people throughout the world. And for us, in terms of just trying to get people to look at that paradox, you know, it's going to take massive education and institutions to really combat that. That's in the long term. But I think in the short term, I think the objective reality is that simply those among us, as small as we may be, those among us who understand what's going on, not only going to have to take the lead in terms of, you know, standing up, but we're going to have to be willing to sacrifice. And that's just no way of getting around that. Because we're talking about a system that is particularly vicious, and that's no question about that. So that's my view in terms of the historical piece around political leadership.
Brother Anthony, how do you view the historical aspects of this whole question of leadership has developed, been used, and I know as a revolutionary organization, a lot of time when you talk about leadership and talk about institutions, two things come to mind to me. It's a question of leadership and institutions are either reform or they revolutionary. Can you speak to the necessity of reform versus revolution when the context of leadership and organization?
Okay, I want to follow up on what Brother Haki had raised. And what I want to point out something that a lot of us do not understand, and that is class struggle in the African community and African societies predates colonialism, predates any foreign invasions. As we were the first people to develop, learning and education, we were also the first people to encounter class struggle. And throughout, the history of the invasions of Africa and African enslavement, you'll find that there were Africans, not necessarily a majority, but there were Africans that collaborated with the oppressor, and that predates colonialism. As a matter of fact, there were class interests in Africa that aided the Europeans in terms of capturing the massive number of Africans that they did to disperse them, to the Western Hemisphere, and so that's where the complication lies, is that we're not only struggling against, outside forces, but also forces that are within our societies. And it has intensified over the centuries to the point where the use of people that look like the masses to oppress us has taken a dominant form, which is neocolonialism, or the new colonialism, to make it plainer. And that has to be understood. So the question of leadership is the fact that you have those forces of Africans who are influenced by and put their individual interests ahead of the interests of the people. And that, as I said, predates, the European incursion, even though the European incursion intensified it. And what imperialists have been able to do throughout the centuries is exploit the various ethnic differences that exist among Africans, because prior to the Maafa that started nearly 500 years ago, a lot of Africans that did not see themselves as one people necessarily. They saw themselves as these different ethnic, groupings. And, unfortunately, there were divisions that outside forces were able to exploit and exacerbate. And that's why you have the situation you have now. And what it's going to take to overcome that is the fact that we need to unite. Because as long as Africa's divided and fragmented, it is going to be open to the atrocities that we have been discussing, throughout the course of this program.
Okay, Sister Ezeal, would you like to take a stab at your analysis of how you see this leadership question? And what would it take to change? Because I think maybe one of the things that we can learn recently from our history is that, when we talk about having movements and transform society, it got to be more of a mass participation and not, a participation directing the people, but the masses must be fully involved and conscious and making choices and deciding what they want. So I'm just wondering, Tess, what's your take on that?
Yes. I'd like to reinforce everything that both the speakers, Brother Haki and the other gentleman, just said with respect to the historical basis of some of our inabilities to maintain a movement. It's that when your comfort is greater, is of more value than your freedom, and perhaps it's part of the human nature, but essentially we have to deal with all those issues about value, and I'll just boil it down to self-love. I don't really speak the language of class, and I think that it's part of what happens in terms of human evolution. And there's always that one person who will be able to take down the lion and bring the meat and have a better living circumstance than the other. But what made, I think, Africans very unique is that we always had, I think, for the most part, a more communal way of living than the European has had. And that more communal way of living doesn't negate the fact that there was, back in those arenas, pre-colonial, pre the Europeans or the Arabs actually getting to the motherland, of Africa, the place where life began. So you have, you can go back historically and talk about how societies developed and why it's possible for this tiny minority that call itself white to outthink us, who might think we are leaders. And I think that's really what we have to start looking at. How is it that we allow ourselves, knowing the blueprint of colonialism or white supremacy, to constantly be out-taught by these systems? And one of the brothers talked about the class issue that predates colonialism and conquest and so forth. And the other brother, talked about the various forms of leadership. And Jesse Jackson's and how we collaborate with injustice and integrate. I always sort of when I'm looking and talking to an audience, I talk about what I see as the two forms of black leadership. I think pretty much across the world, you're either Toussaint Louverture or you're Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and so in America you could say Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. You can go back to Du Bois and the other guy, the guy that did, Garvey. So you have black leaders, black males, okay, and then I will speak about females, black males who are elevated or looked upon or quoted. Folks, you know, let me speak about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. You know, they wanted the same thing for the universe and the planet. But I think that Christianity and white education puts us so far behind before we actually see reality. And you could see it in both of those giants, history, both of those giants. You know, both of these are heroes for us. But, however, you know, one integrated with injustice didn't understand what supremacy was, in my opinion, with regards to Dr. King. And then another, you know, tried to work his way once he understood what was going on and said, you know, by any means necessary, we cannot integrate with this injustice. And he's sort of like in that line with Marcus Garvey. We have got to love ourselves, find out our roots, and be so secure within ourselves that then we can go out and meet these Europeans on a different ground. And I think that's the critical part of any organization is that first that loving yourself and understanding a different value system, because white supremacy will change what whiteness is every time. And that's when we talk about leadership, some of the leadership has been there, but they are able to change the definition of whiteness at will. So that today, as the Latino population gets to be bigger and bigger, all of a sudden, you know, it used to be one drop and you're black and you're out. Now, you know, Zimmerman can decide whether he's white or not, you know. So, and then white society can decide whether to admit him into whiteness. And by his very act, they were able to admit him into whiteness and forget about his Afro-Peruvian mother. So I think that we quite have to be ahead of the game, because, you know, there was a time in Europe where all that we say about the ethnicity and of Africa was going on with the European tribes, you know, where the Russians and the various others of that, whatever you call it, Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, you know, the Romanians and these people, or the Armenians, these people were not considered white. Today they're considered white. So we have to understand what this is about, essentially, what white supremacy is about. So the Irish, for you know, 700 years were fighting the British, and they weren't considered white. They came to the United States and they were white, and there was a reason for that. There's a reason why when Haiti won its independence, the Spanish and the French were all both trying to come back, and one of the ways they came back was to send, you know, boatloads and boatloads of their poor Germans and their poor, you know, Swiss and their poor to that arena, to that place we call now Dominican Republic. So I think in terms of leadership, we have to look at the changing nature of white supremacy and how every time we move the line and push for universal freedom, not these biological ways, because essentially we have to go back as Africans and understand that these are, you know, these are our children, these white men and women who have gone bonkers. I mean, essentially, I think scientifically it's time for a group of anthropologists to actually study these folks, these psychopaths, that sort of bad part in human nature that will put profit over people and do it consistently to the point of creating genocide in country after country after country, and barbarity. It's a question of value. It's a question of understanding our greater role, not just as African Americans in America with a history of 400 years of enslavement, or Haitians with a history of X, Y, and Z, but in this planet, on this universe. You know, you have, for instance, I give an example of something. I met a woman, Angela Mollett, over in Oklahoma, when we started teaching that, you know, we are
because when I was growing up, it took so long to actually get a grasp of what was right and what was wrong based on the false, deceptive education of the white man and the white school that I went to. You know, just it took a very, very long time. And I think many of us have had that experience. But once you realize that you are Aboriginal to the world and you start trying to connect with other folks who are on that same page, you know, in Oklahoma, there's a woman named Angela Mollett who's a native first people, a black, who is Ototon, who is a black woman whose lineage started before, and she could, you know, started before Columbus, way back. And these black, let's say, Indians, for lack of another word to describe it at the moment, I can't think of another word, but these black Indians that were here before 1492, before Columbus came, you know, I mean, there's a story there that I think it's critically important for leaders to be able to say to our young folks, listen, wherever you stand, Africa is the motherland of the universe, of this planet Earth. But we are Aboriginal to the world, and we're here in the Western Hemisphere before he came. And here's how our societies worked then. And here is one of the parts of that society that is good, because there's always good and there's always bad. And part of what is good, part of what I think is indigenous to who we are as Africans, is that we lived in communal ways where we actually took care of the weak. We actually took care of children. Those type of things that are gone now today, where it's all about, you know, let's move up and get a job, even if you're not, this is not part of your spiritual way of extending yourself into the world, but if it can make you money. And then you end up having these people who are so disconnected with self that you know, you can have Susan Rice, a black woman, or you can have Condi Rice, a black woman, presiding over genocide in Africa, whether it's in the Congo or in Rwanda or right now in Libya with Susan Rice and the, you know, it's thinkable. But we're not teaching our children these connections. And I think that the more we do that and the more we understand that we have to, that in this paradigm of leadership where you go from one thinking that integrates with injustice and one thinking that says, no, I don't want to integrate with this whatsoever, Marcus Garvey. I'm going to, you know, make my own the land and be master first of my own self, my own values, my own children, my own history. And then I will extend into the world, which is how China, as someone said, I think last night, how China was able to grab itself out of the mouth of colonialism. And we know there's tons and tons of something wrong with that. But to answer your question about leadership, I think that the pattern that I see is, you know, one revolutionary who feels that, you know, he has to go within the system of white supremacy and change within that system the laws that makes legal inequality. And then we have another group that says, hey, listen, no matter, we can't participate in the system whatsoever because it was founded on genocide. I stand with the revolutionaries like Garvey, like Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who said we want a black independent country, not a black rule French colony like what we have right now all over Africa, except for perhaps Mugabe. So I think we have to be clear. I'm very clear about those two trends in terms of revolutionaries. But I think also one of our big failures as people is that we have totally, because we don't look at Aboriginal to the world, and then we don't look at the spiritual side of that, with regards to, you know, we are both human and spirit, and in that space, there is a harmony with our planet. And as the brother who left said, you know, the planet is moaning. And as far as I know, the only person that gives birth is a woman. And it's very difficult as a female for me to have found, you know, leaders that I would want to follow that were women who stood up and said no to the whether it was their children, you know, this idea that children have to go get a job and that means that they're fulfilled. And some of the values. So I think that we first have to elevate the black woman as mother of the races. I think that is something that I always talk about constantly. I say from Offset to ISIS to Esli Duntal. Esli Duntal came first, and yet nobody knows what that is and what that means. And it's that irreducible essence of the female energy that we all carry, but that gives birth. And that was the energy that I think that we also as a people have to concentrate on, because until we do, patriarchy is what the European totally is about. Even in his own space, he had to get rid of the women and burn his mother and his daughters as witches, there was a war on women doesn't get talked about in the leadership of the African American community that I see, and I think that I am inspired by the work of Marie McLeod Mattoon, you know, when she said to use what's in your hands. And I think that's pivotal, that leaders, those of us who are out here trying in some ways to find a space so that suffering bodies will stop suffering, so that the value of the human being is our priority. We have to use what's in our hands. And so though I look to Jean-Jacques Dessalines for where to go, though I look for a Grundy Otone in all the women of the Haitian Revolution, those that we know, I also, when I talk and think about, those we have to elevate, the women and who came before and who worked so hard to liberate, and I can't remember the sister's name, but who basically said, I would have freed more if they knew they were enslaved. And I think that's
Harriet
the thing.
Tubman.
There you go. Thank you so much. So we are fighting a war of values, and that war of values because, they had free men back in the day of slavery. And I always kind of connect that with, let's say, the NFL players, the celebrities, the Oprah Winfreys, the Cosbys. You know, we still got free men, the people who make money within the system and who are elevated as successful. We're fighting the fact that's beautiful and admiring at one level. And there's a role for those folks who are able to live and work within that system, and pretty much not see the child in the cabin being raped or the person on pretty much not see it. I mean, there's a role, and a lot of times those who work within the system and actually integrate with it have been pivotal in funding revolutionary movement, and we have to acknowledge that. I think in terms of leadership, we have to be as nuanced as possible. We have to understand the overarching ways of what the white supremacist system is about. We know, for instance, I'll say maybe three or four of what it's about. It's about profit over people, and the racism that's structural, not these isolated cases where we're talking about, but structural racism which within the society makes people act a particular way, including black people, has to be destroyed. That has to be destroyed. That cannot integrate with a system that makes you hate yourself and carry out the interests of somebody else. That has to be. But then we also have that system that of sexism. And to understand that the white man will use every weapon and commodify it. So as I was saying last night, they're using black people all over the media to simplify stuff and to make as if the United States is somehow, you know, post-racial when it is not. And they're using women in the same manner as this commodity, as this brand. And as we look at, you know, whether it's Argentina, Chile, or Brazil, all three have women presidents. But they're presiding over the same neoliberalism, let's privatize public asset way of the capitalist, as, you know, Mrs. Clinton does and will do if she becomes president. So just because you're a female doesn't mean you're revolutionary. Just because you're black doesn't mean you're a revolutionary. There has to be a clearer way of defining what progress is in this day and age, because we're living in a different system. It wasn't the system where Malcolm and Martin was, where we had apartheid and so forth. It's a different way, and that different way has to be articulated, I think.
Okay, we'd like to
bring up can I respond real quick?
Let me stop you 1 second. I'll come back to you, Brother Hackey. I just want to make an announcement to our audience. They've been waiting for a while, and we can encourage them to call back. To let our audience know that we now have our line open, feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. Make sure you punch 1 so we can see you on that board, and we'll recognize your last 1 number. I'd like to remind everybody, we are doing this special program. It's a series of a program that Africa on the Move is doing in honor of this upcoming great event, African Liberation Day. Will take place May the 17th at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest, Washington, D.C. So we'd like to encourage all our brothers and sisters to come on out. Let's have the dialogue that was needed. Let's connect ourselves with our brothers and sisters around the world by being there. At the same time, we must encourage you to remember that without information, you cannot think, and without organization, you cannot think clearly. This particular event, under the sponsorship and organizational aspect of the All African People Promotion by GC, will take place on the 17th. So let's continue to move forward. Brother Hackey, you have something you want to say. Go ahead, Brother Hackey.
Real succinctly. Sister made up a very interesting point in terms of the sociopathic propensity among practitioners, you know, of this government. It's a very interesting point, and it's very, very true. As a matter of fact, Ralph Nader, last week, he asked leading psychologists in the American Psychiatric Association, he asked them, why don't they label the fact that you've got these corporate types, these politicians, you know, who routinely lie, who hurt people, who have no remorse. Why don't you give them a classification? Well, none of the psychologists in that association responded. In other words, it hit too close to home, because clearly, when you look at the behavior and attitude of these individuals, clearly it's very, very, you know, sociopathic. Irony is that in order for African people in this society to elevate, you have to exhibit certain mindset, a certain proclivity, you know, if you're going to elevate. They want you to be just like them, and that's very, very scary. So when you look at Barack Obama, and he stands before you, and he pretends like he's oblivious to what's going on in the Central African Republic, you realize that just how much he has internalized these sociopathic values. And generally speaking, you realize just how much politicians generally, corporate types generally, have internalized sociopathic values. And this is a scary thing, that for too many in society, we see those kind of values as appropriate. We don't even question it. We can point out this kind of inappropriateness when we see some kid on the street doing something, you know, ridiculous. But we can't point it out when it comes to the so-called leaders in the society. So it's a very, very good point. And one other thing real quickly is that when we talk about political leadership, we got to talk about the role of the media. Now, during the time that Marcus Garvey, King, and Malcolm came along, you know, the cameras, the technology was in the infancy. So therefore, you know, they were very, very curious to use that new technology. So they gave these brothers visibility. Now, the capitalists have got more shrewd as time as the technology has evolved. No longer would they use that technology to expose people who are truly committed to the masses of people who suffer, you know, under the guise of capitalism. So to a large extent, they, in fact, legitimize our leadership. So, consequently, you only can get people like, you know, your typical congresswoman, you know, Maxine Waters or Sheila Jackson Lee and these kind of individuals who essentially, or the brother Cummings out of Maryland, who merely told the line, you know, of the powerful. You're not, they're not going to put on television people like Cynthia McKinney, former congresswoman, you know, who's, I mean, who's very, very strong, who's very committed, you know, to humanity, you know, who's very committed to her people, very committed to fighting injustice. Those kind of people don't get visibility. So the struggle for us is that we have to create institutions to legitimize leadership. We have to do it. And that's a much tougher challenge in terms of pulling off, because by and large at this point, we're just so disorganized, it's very, very difficult to do. But the, one of the things that we have to do when we talk about the role of institutions is that we have to legitimize our leadership. We have to prop them up. We have to make sure everybody knows who they are. You know, we got to hold them accountable. So this is the kind of thing we have to do. So we can, at this point, we can ill afford to for the system, you know, to get the true story out. They're not going to do it. It's not their interest to prop up or to expose, or, you know, to the masses of people who are truly committed to justice. So that's not going to happen. So we have to legitimize the leadership.
And making that transition, talking about leadership, I think we can't talk about leadership without really talking about organization. Organization, people suppose, you know, leadership. And I'd like to address this question right now to Brother Anthony in terms of this issue of a couple of things. We can see today, right now, we don't have control of our youth, our children. The enemy has control of our children, which also means is a strong probability they'll have control of our future as long as this maintains itself. As a political organization, and we talk about discretionary organization, how do we get our control of our children back? And at the same time, can you just talk just a little bit about this whole question of the importance of critiquing the capitalist system and letting the people know the alternative, you know, because, you know, right now, there seems to be a point of view that there are another alternative to living other than the way we're living. So what alternative do our people have, and how do we get back in terms of get back in control of our children?
Well, I think this is where institutions like African Liberation Day and other, institutions that we have available to us come into play. We have to teach our youth especially, our people in general, but our youth especially, they have a choice to make, either to serve the interests of the masses of our people, which is to be revolutionary, or to serve the interests of our enemy, to serve the interests of the few. And right now, because of imperial bourgeois control of the media and educational system, our people are not not aware that they have a choice to make. A lot of our people think that this capitalist system is the only way to go, and a lot of us have bought into that. Those of us who are opposed to that, we have to present our people with the truth that they have a choice to make. And history as a guide has shown us that people have made those choices. Sister Ezeli, pointed that out very eloquently. And those choices that every one of us has to make. Either we're gonna, look out for our own selfish interests, or are we going to look out for the interests of the people as a whole? And as imperialism intensifies, its stranglehold over the planet is becoming clearer and clearer. People have a choice to make, and we have to, and it's our job for those of us who know those options to make that aware to the masses of our people. So in terms of we have to, you know, use all means at our disposal to educate our youth and to build revolutionary organizations.
Brother Haki, can you speak to this question of socialism versus capitalism as an alternative and have people need to become more critical in terms of understanding these systems and how they fit in the schemes of things? Because it's clear that, you know, they have this propaganda machinery going on where most people are scared to even talk about that concept or the S-word. How have they been able to allow us to participate in their own oppression while at the same time scared to seek alternatives that will be that will alleviate us from this oppression?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, clearly, when you talk about socialism versus communism, it's a real dichotomy. There is no question, just in terms of needs and aspirations of people, a socialist system is preferable. There's no question about that. Now, implicit in socialism is the notion that there's concern for people, number one. And as I just alluded to earlier, you know, there is a communal aspect of socialism. And also there's an understanding that wealth doesn't, or money doesn't precede the needs of human beings. That's all implicit in a socialist system. Now, if we contrast that with a capitalist system, clearly, you know, the most negative attributes, the most negative kind of connotations around, you know, proliferate. For instance, when we talk about capitalism, what are we talking about? Individualism. We talk about selfishness. We talk about greed, avarice. We're talking about destruction, chaos. You know, we talk about all those things which as a conscious human being, you strive not to do. Capitalism actually inculcates and encourages those kind of attributes. So in final analysis, what it does, it creates the worst kind of human being. Now, just in terms of fundamentally how the system works, now when we look at the terms of disparity, when we talk about between the have and the have-nots, now even though, you know, the father of capitalism, Adam Smith, said that, listen, capitalism is a very dangerous system. Without government overreach, without government overseeing capitalism, it will destroy. He was very clear on that point. When we look at today and we look at the disparity between those who have and those who don't have, it's very, very clear that this whole process is very, very destructive. And more importantly, one of the things is that with such an imbalance, not only destructive to people, but it's even destructive to capitalism itself. Because what happens is that in order for capitalism to exist, you got to have a certain value, a certain amount of money going through the system in terms of impossible for the system to expand. The system can't expand if it doesn't have any money going through it. And all the money is at the top. And people at the top tend not to spend. So it doesn't make any sense. Particularly when you talk about in the context of consumer spending. Now, 70% of GDP is consumer spending. What damn sense does it make? What damn sense does it make? To take money out of the hands of working people or poor people. Those are the people who stimulate the economy by spending, but they don't have any money to spend. And as a consequence, businesses go under because nobody got any money to spend. You can't hire anybody because there's no money circulating. So people are tight with the money. So it's very chaotic and a very crazy kind of system. And ultimately what happens is that in the process of excluding so many people from any kind of economic vitality in the system, then what happens is you indirectly create a large surplus of people which you have no need for. So the question that comes to the capitalist class is, what do you do with all of these people you don't need? And this is a fundamental question that people have to understand. They're somehow thinking that if it's just be pragmatic, if it's just be quiet and just play by the rules, that it's going to be all right. They don't understand that in the eyes of the capitalists, you have no surplus value. And so, therefore, in their mind, the question is, how do we eradicate all these people who are useless? Now, certainly one of the ways they do it in terms of when you look at the expenditures as there's a social safety net. Now, they've been cutting social safety nets since Reagan back in the 80s. Now, the Republican Congress is talking about cutting the social safety net by $125 billion. Well, of course, the Democrats are a bit more kind, so they want to cut it by $80 billion. Either way, it's going to be devastating to women and children. But who cares? If that's an ingenious way in terms of actually stressing people out, eventually leading to their death, then for the capitalists, it's a good thing. It's a very good thing. These people are ruthless. Capitalism is very, very ruthless. It's inhuman. So when we talk about sociopathic values, then we got to understand that is the quintessential capitalist system. That is what capitalism is all about. Totally void of inner feeling, totally void of justice, totally void of what's right. Was, you know, what's wrong. So So in terms of the aspiration of people, there's no question about it. If you want to create the high-functioning human being, there's got to be socialism. Socialism makes sure that people are imbued with education, affordable housing, a social existence where you can walk down the street without being afraid that somebody's going to attack you. Now, this is a very good contrast. When you look at the United States compared to Canada, and Canada's socialist, it's like night and day, night and day. So the question in terms of, you know, access to food, access to shelter, education, clothes, and so forth and so on, is not an issue in Canada. So people are not living in the streets. People are not hungry. Children don't go to school with their bellies growling because they don't have anything to eat, or they're on a sugar diet. My mom can only afford to give them a candy bar for breakfast. You know, it's a totally different world. It's a totally different world. And the Canadians don't have a problem in terms of, in order to make sure that the socialism works, that just like Europe, they spend an enormous amount of money on a social safety net because this is the kind of society they want to live in. The capitalists have convinced our people that the only real existence is a capitalist existence. And this is possible because most of our people don't get the opportunity to get outside America to see other ways of doing things. But no question about it, if there's a choice to be made for the masses of people in terms of their aspirations, the things that they need, socialism is the key. And let me just one other thing to conclude. Now, socialism exists in America, but socialism exists for the wealthy. So when we talk about things like interest rates, when we talk about inflation, when we talk about exchange rates, when we talk about all that stuff, all we're ingeniously talking about is that it's transferring wealth from the poorest sector of the society to the most wealthy sector of society. That's all that is. I'm not going to break it down. I'm going to bore people with a long lecture in terms of how that works. But the point is that socialism, there's not a problem with socialism that allows pertains to white folks, I mean to the wealthy folks. But the moment you talk about socialism for everybody else, then it becomes a problem. So socialism is definitely the way to go in terms of, you know, a higher functioning society.
I would direct this question to our sister Azila. We have problems in Haiti. We have problems in Brazil. We have problems in Africa. How can we best play a role in helping our people considering all of the problems they have? What can we do right now? What would be your diagnosis of how could we help our brothers and sisters in Haiti and elsewhere? What can the people do?
Okay. Essentially, the black woman's child all across the world is at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. In Haiti in particular, because that's where I work 24/7, you know, we have different issues. The most important thing, I think, that folks in solidarity with universal freedom should do is to really expose that there is a U.S. occupation in Haiti, and that U.S. occupation is detrimental to Haitian sovereignty. And until there is no occupation, there is no foreign forces, there is no NGOs, there is, you know, no white folks coming in or black folks coming in and taking the land of the peasants so that they can say we are developed, then you know, we're not in solidarity. So I think that those who want to help should support the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network and the Free Haiti Movement. Should help us financially, should help us as, you know, coming into the movement with us. There are specific things that we're working for, you know, because we have to go after ending the occupation is number one. Looking at some of these issues that, for instance, Brother Haki talked about, the sociopathic values of these folks. And I always say that, anthropology was invented
to study black people, and we need to invent another sort of discipline to actually study the people who are destroying the universe and the planet. Because, you know, the more you learn, the more you understand that perhaps the Neanderthal gene did not get taken out of these Europeans and Asiatic folks up there who are destroying and who find it plausible in a planet of over 7 billion people that they're telling you, and in a world of abundance, spiritually abundant, they're telling you that they have to keep the prices high so that they can make an acceptable profit. And it's acceptable to do genocide in Nigeria, genocide in Congo, genocide in Haiti, in order to have these oil companies have a profit. I think that we're not educating our people to understand. Really, for me, I sort of turn out. I used to turn out when people said capitalism and socialism, because like whiteness, it has changed. And so we're always responding as opposed to being the people that actually, put out, this is what my fight is. And I say, with regards to capitalism in Haiti, it's monopolies. It's not capitalism as it was invented. I mean, this is about corporate welfare. That's all it is. And so capitalism is corporate welfare. And as the brother was saying, with regards to interest rate and inflation, the whole system is about corporate welfare. It's about stealing from the rich and giving to, stealing from the poor, and giving to the rich. And that's really what it's about. And we have to be able to articulate that outside of these other paradigms, I think, coming from someone who wasn't in the generation of Marxism and communism and so forth, I always sort of tune out. And I don't know if that's something with regards to, how I entered the system. But the way I entered as someone, who accidentally became a leader here, is that in Haiti we have the same oligarchy, the same folks who come from Syria and Lebanon, Christians that were fleeing persecution in their own countries. They got asylum for Haiti. They're light-skinned guys who are white, who have replaced the bourgeoisie in Haiti that the United States government, was pushing to the mulattoes. And these guys, whether it's Bijou, Akwa, Merv, I name them because you don't see the names of the billionaire intermediaries in the Caribbean that are the collaborators and the bachotes who maintain the system that vie for the soul of black folks. And so I think part of the what can you do? You can help expose the American companies that hire these subcontractors for empire. For instance, there's a big kidnapping ring in Haiti right now. And that kidnapping ring is run out of a well-known American dealership affiliate. So that dealership is in Haiti. That dealership is being run by the family called Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T. And they've been doing this for 10 years or more. They don't get, because they service the U.S., and the U.S. interest in Haiti, they don't get exposed. The companies that are so well known in the United States as being, good companies do not get exposed. I think it's time for us to expose these companies that are in Africa, these companies that are in Haiti, that are pushing genocide through their collaborators, their subcontractors, I call them Category Zero. So that's one thing that you can do. With regards to really understanding that capitalism in general is about big monopolies. They control now U.S. legislation to provide them with pretty much whatever they want. They, just like the brother was saying, how back in the day, technology was new during the time of Garvey and Malcolm, and then so that they helped the world know who these people are. And now We have lots of various
fighters. Let me just stop
fighters.
You for one second. Just let me stop you for one second and just alert our listening audience that they are about to lose us in a minute or so. For those who's online listening, they can continue this conversation with us if they go online and call in 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. And as always, you always can go to the archives and view the entirety of the show by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Africa-on-the-move. Okay, sister, continue.
Okay, very quickly, I guess I should say that, so you have monopolies, and then they want to tell you these monopolies are capitalism. When Bush was trying to give $7 billion to Wall Street, you know, he basically, that was corporate welfare. And he acknowledged he had to, you know, use socialism to maintain capitalism. And this is what they do. So we have to look, me, when I'm talking with regards to Haiti, and you know, like I said, we have a communal way of living. If you go to Haiti, there's these lacus where families live in these compounds, and they've been doing that for over 500 years in my family in Haiti. And I always say there are certain things, okay, and you know, there's, because, you know, some of our greatest enemies, Canada and France, are socialists, I just don't even bother with any, because, you know, Canada helped to bring the coup d'etat and regime change in Haiti. They are in Haiti because they are the groups of folks whose mining companies, because of U.S. mining laws, all the United States corporations reincorporate themselves in Canada, and they are now in Haiti. So they always switch themselves, and they go to their brothers, their other white settlers, to come and do anything to us that they want to do. And whether it's France socialism or it's Canadian socialism, you know, I always say that I can actually point to the indigenous way of life of Haiti. And so there are, we say, and I think perhaps it could be global, but we say development for Haiti is to actually give value to the 70 to 80% market women who not own in the way of Europeans owning land, but who actually are in trust of land, where they are farmers. Because in Haiti, there's a different way of land. I mean, there is a land ownership, and there's people who have been on their properties, like, you know, in my family, we live in a village where we've been there for centuries. But there are others who use land in Haiti. And so we have 70 to 80% of the people in Haiti are peasants. But the GDP of Haiti does not reflect the value of the land they own or what they do. So the informal economy in Haiti is totally ignored, just like one of the brothers was talking about Zimbabwe and how the giving back of land from the white settlers who had stolen it, it's 65%, he was saying, of women. So you have women all over Africa who are peasants, who are merchants, and who've been the backbone. In Haiti, they are the backbone of the informal economy, but that informal economy is, as the brother was saying, you know, if you're not on the grid, they don't count you. And so I'm always looking for economists, Haitian economists, to look at Haiti and count what the informal economy is, because when they tell you that Haitians are living on $2 a day, they have taken totally out the fact that we own that damn island, and there is a value to that land that these folks own and have. And so because we are dealing with their paradigm and we're dealing with their way of thinking, they can marginalize the lives of 70% of the people in Haiti or 65% of the people in Zimbabwe. And so I think it behooves us to be able to say these things, to say that just because you're off the grid does not mean you're poor, and we have to define what poor is. And it's more than we have to define wealth. Let's put it that way. So essentially, those who want to help us, I think that, you know, I think the brother who left talked about us getting together. I think that's critically important because sometimes, you know, I know that at the Haitian Lord Leadership and at the Free Haiti Movement, we feel fairly alone, especially when we're fighting for right now to keep the offshore islands in Haiti to be Haitian. And we have to, you know, reach out to Venezuela activists. We have to reach out to Cuban activists. We have to reach out to, you know, others that say that they're anti-imperialist. And so you might, folks, you know, who have connection to those people, it would be important to us because, you know, we have brothers and sisters right now. They're putting dogs on them on that island so that and silencing them. And the mass media is not reporting it. We are the only one reporting it. So folks who are listening who want to help can circulate those stories, can help us reach those activists in those other areas to say, you know, if you really are anti-imperialist, why in the hell are you putting $27 million in Haiti tourism? That really means about taking, you know, giving hoteliers, foreign hoteliers, the property of poor Haitians. So some of those solidarity things I think is important, and definitely we need that help in Haiti. Anybody, you know, my it's Esli Dantor. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on LinkedIn. We are definitely, you know, we have a website so where you can find the information. That's it.
Okay. Brother Effie, can you talk a little bit about the history and development and the historical role or call for building a political party that would be capable of addressing all of these ills on a global basis? And that's the part I'm talking about, that Nkrumah called into existence in
66, 67. Okay.
And later on, taken up by Sekou Touré and Kwame Touré. Can you talk to the people why a party like this is of a necessity and how they can participate?
Well, when Ghana obtained its independence in 1957, Nkrumah realized that Ghana's independence was meaningless without the liberation of the entire African continent. And he worked throughout his political career to bring about the unification and liberation of all of Africa. Because without that land base, no African anywhere in the world would truly be free. And history has shown that to be the case. The reason why Africans suffer the way they do throughout the world is because Africa is not free and unified under scientific socialism. And I think the key reason why socialism has the stigma that it does in the diaspora is because of capitalism, which, as Kwame Touré points out, seeks to warp people thinking, in addition to controlling their resources. And we have to do more to fight against that. And I think the information that Sister Ezili laid out about Haiti is very important, that we disseminate that to the masses of our people so that they're more aware. Because, let's see, without that knowledge, we cannot take the appropriate action. And I'm sure that if Africans in Cuba and Venezuela were more aware of, about the situation going on in Haiti, then they would not be collaborating with its exploitation, as has been indicated. And so I think political education for our people becomes very important, and becomes very important that we who are resisting imperialism wherever in the world it manifests itself communicate with each other. We have to have an exchange of information so that we share our experiences and that will bring about the coming together of a leadership that can alleviate you know, this situation.
How do African Liberation Day fit into schemes and everything?
African Liberation Day fits in because it's an institution where we bring together different political parties and progressive organizations that we have relationships with from different parts of the world to talk about what they're doing in the battle against imperialism and its last manifestation, neocolonialism. And it becomes very important to that African Liberation Day we marked on work struggle and for Pan-Africanism and socialism and our role in that process. And to emphasize that people who have through the sweat of the masses of the people acquired their education have a choice to make in terms of how they choose to put that to use.
And we can add an African Liberation Day for those who never been. It offers you an opportunity to get information from the primary sources, not second and third secondary sources, but primary sources. Get to actually meet the people who's on the ground, who's doing the work, and get to have this kind of discourse where you very seldom have in this society, because as we stated earlier, there's a monopoly to not to have knowledge and information share among the masses. And this is why we highly encourage folks to come out this year and support African Liberation Day. And we take win and well, Brother Anthony.
Okay. African Liberation Day will take place at the Festival Center located at 1640 Columbia Road Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. And for more information, people can visit our website, www.aaprp-gc.org. Or they can contact us at 202-719-0529.
Yeah, well, I believe, Brother Anthony, we have that. It will take place at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest. And your theme is Smash Neocolonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter Revolution. And looking at the theme, seems like a lot of discussion that we had tonight is could fall under that theme. And I would like to go back to Brother Haki right now in the transition. If he could speak to his take on this thing dealing with Boko Haram, can you share with our audience how could something like this happen, given the fact that, you know, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of children in the country and the government knows nothing about it? What is your analysis on that?
Yeah, well, simply stating is the highest order duplicity. Clearly, what those guys are doing is antithetical to revolution. The notion that you can alienate large number of people can do such horrendous things as abducting those young girls speaks to a kind of insanity in which no revolutionary group would ever exhibit. So clearly, these guys are working under the auspices of the CIA, and the whole idea is to destabilize Africa. Number one, warn the tourism industry in Africa, justify the involvement of the U.S. military, overall just to destabilize Nigeria because Nigeria's wealth and its abundance of resources. So clearly this is a ploy by the West in terms of getting what it wants in terms of resources.
So Zizeli, you got a take on it? I'm quite sure you see that parallel between what's going on in Nigeria and the history of the struggle of our brothers and sisters Haiti throughout the world. But what's your take on it?
On Boko Haram? Well, you know, we started, when this happened on April 15th or the night of 14th to the 15th, and, you know, we got some calls from some of the folks we stand in solidarity with, and they said, you know, the mothers were not getting any sort of response from the government. A week went by, and I really didn't feel qualified, as I said last night, to speak on this stuff because I didn't, always wary of the United States' involvement in terrorism. Wasn't understanding exactly, how it was possible for these folks to exist and do what they were doing. So I was very happy, but by the second week, actually, when the mothers, there were so many different stories coming out of the Good Luck organization, government, that, and the women and the parents, it was such a helpless situation. The parents took bicycles and mopeds and went into the forest themselves. That's how desperate they were. And I felt that pain because I have spent decades and decades representing women who have been raped by death squad leaders in Haiti and even in the Ivory Coast. And so it's something... pedophilia, the sexualization of our children is something that I have pretty much have spent my career working against. There is a law, a U.S. law, that was first used in Haiti, and we had a lot to do with pushing that law. It was against tourism that is used for illicit sex, where folks, go to Haiti, and it's about pedophilia activity. And that guy, Douglas Perlez, it took us 6 years to help put him in jail, is now spending 19 years in jail. And so I have a legal experience of dealing with pedophiles going to Africa, going to Haiti, going to these lands and taking advantage of our children. So it hurt. It was a horrifying atrocity, the fact that the parents felt so bad. So, yes, we at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, by the second week, we came out with a statement against the inactivity of the Nigerian government and pushing bring back our girls. Today, though, lots of celebrities have taken this up. And you don't really see the black women who are out here doing this. And we have on our website pictures of groups of black women in New York who stood up this day before the advent of the mass media. So I have two opinions with regards to that, bring back the girls. One is that personal horrifying look and thinking that right now as we speak, these young girls between 15 and 18, and some people say they are maybe younger, are being defiled, raped. Their pain is ongoing. And with what we have learned about this group, there's testimony that they rape some of these girls between 5 to 15 men per day. So it is so horrifying. On the other hand, it's always important to have a context with regard to the suffering of black across the world. And so, so in the same stance, the Nigerian parents, the still same back on girls, but also which is right above northeast Nigeria. I don't know what these people are. More likely than not. About it, we want to know why the Nigerian group is not protecting its own. But it's like me saying, why isn't the Haitian government protecting its own people? It's in that we have a Haitian government the interest of retiring its own citizens. Similarly, the Nigerian government don't serve. They're servicing of the out there in the south. Then, for me, no problem.
Sissy Zilly?
Yes.
Can you hear me? I think we're having some technical problems in terms of the last minute, so we're hearing you. You're coming in and out. What I would like to do, if we can, in closing, I'll ask each one of y'all to make a statement in support of African Liberation Day and to encourage our brothers and sisters to come on out this weekend and support the event. I'll start with you, Brother Hackey. Why they should support it, and then make an appeal to our people to come out this weekend in Washington, D.C. on the 17th at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest, from 2 to 6 p.m.
African Liberation Day is one of the most important institutions you ever visit. It's very, very important in terms of, gaining information, actually learning things in terms of the kind of things that are going on around the world that are so pertinent to the aspiration of African people. So by all means, please get there. There's much to be learned, and you have a good time at the same time.
Sissy Zilly, statement of support for African Liberation Day this year.
Yes, I will urge anyone. I think what you're doing is an amazing job. I have learned so much, and I think that everyone hearing who has the ability to get to the event, I think it would be great because you meet folks like the work that they're doing. It's important that we all connect. So I would everyone to support this event for you.
Brother Anthony, make your appeal. Tell the people having found out more about it. And not only can they give you political support, but how they can also financially support you, even if they can't come. Because this is a movement. We know where, after that economic dependency, there cannot be no true freedom. So our people need to understand the necessity of supporting our people movement. So go ahead, Brother Anthony.
Okay, certainly. I think it's important that people come out to African Liberation Day this year because of the theme, Smash the Neocolonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. It will provide an opportunity to learn more about our struggle, the history of it, and to interact with, with people from different backgrounds and nationalities who are struggling against similar things. And we can learn more, and it gives an opportunity to dialogue and learn more about each other. And so I think it's an excellent opportunity to find out more about the revolutionary struggle. And if you cannot come in person, you can help in other ways. You can visit our website. You can make a donation, and there is a link that allows you to do that. And you can also read about the history of our party and the history of the Pan-Africanism. And our website, www.a-aprp-gc.org. And you can contact us via email at info@a-aprp-gc.org. Or you can also contact us at 202-719-0529. If you have the time and resources, by all means, please come out to African Liberation Day, scheduled for May 17th, a Saturday from 2 to 6 p.m. at the Festival Center, located at 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest, Washington, D.C.
And just briefly in closing, we'd like to thank our listening audience, our friends, our supporters for allowing us to come to their homes this evening and sharing this special edition of Africa on the Move. Africa on the Move is a community project of the All African, is a community project of the African Wellness Association. And what we want to do is use technology as a means to help communicate to our people and give them the necessary information that can transform their lives, transform their conditions, and transform the realities of Africa and African people. Until next time, we'll be on tomorrow from 4 to 6. Please share that with your friends. Call in tomorrow evening from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will continue our series on African Liberation Day 2014 and African Unity. Until next time, as your host, Brother Africa, let's strive to go always forward and backwards never. Always strive to go forward, ever, backwards never. We thank you. Good night.